Thank you very much, Jim, and hello to everyone that's here. And thank you for being here. Thank you for taking an interest in this subject. It's so crucial to today and the environment that we're in. I agreed to speak without really paying much attention to the topic initially, and it was only when I began to prepare that I began to think, what did Jim talk me into here? I'm supposed to address this relationship between punishment and morality. You know, probably the most intractable debate in philosophy, theology, social justice in the history of civilization, and addressed by those whose competence in this area goes far beyond mine. Indeed, the competence of how it was addressed this morning in the service was profound and important, and I'm very grateful for that introduction, those themes. I can only tell you how it's worked for me. I want to talk about how I've reconciled working in corrections with while also trying to be moral, or striving to be moral. And to begin, I wanted to quote a famous speech, or part of a famous speech, by Winston Churchill. You've probably heard this before if you've been in this field at all, but it's a speech he gave in 1910 when he was the Home Secretary in Parliament. And it went like this. We must not forget that when every material improvement has been effected in prison, when the temperature has been rightfully adjusted, when the proper food to maintain health and strength has been given, when the doctors, chaplains, and prison visitors have come and gone, the convict stands deprived of everything that a free man calls life. We must not forget that all of these improvements, which are sometimes salves to our conscience, do not change that position. The mood and temper of the public in regard to the treatment of crime and criminals is one of the most unfailing tests of the civilization of any country. A calm and dispassionate recognition of the rights of the accused against the state and even the convicted criminals against the state, a constant heart searching by all charged with the duty of punishment, the desire and eagerness to rehabilitate in the world of industry all those who have paid their dues in the hard coinage of punishment, tireless efforts towards the discovery of curative and regenerative processes, and unfaltering faith that there is a treasure if you can only find it in the heart of every man. These are the symbols which, in the treatment of crime and criminals, mark and measure the stored-up strength of a nation and are the sign and proof of the living virtue in it. It's astonishing when you think that speech was given 40 years before the UN adopted human rights provisions that have come since. But there's several messages that I just want to reiterate that were important to me. That even when all that is conceivable can be done to reduce the pain and harm of imprisonment, the convict still stands deprived of everything that a free man calls life. There's a substantial limit to what we can do in a prison environment to make it less than entirely punitive and painful. The search for the treasure in the heart of every person is not a naive weakness. It's not an unrealistic expectation. It's not just a goofy kind of sentiment. It's the unfailing test of the civilization of the country. Thirdly, the message is that we must address the needs of people. And the greatest need of people is generally not punishment. Whatever the rationale for punishment, it's meeting the needs of people that allows them to grow and mature and live in society. And finally, this is the part that struck me, given the time in which it was given, that we must always be respectful of the human rights of those. Okay, then fourth point was that we always have to recognize the human rights. And this is long before human rights were part of the dialogue, certainly in relation to corrections. The history of criminal justice was that prisoners had no rights. They had considered to be civilly dead, or in the United States they were referred to as slaves of the state. So to think that in 1910 a politician would stand up in the House of Commons and make a statement like that is profound and important, and to me sums up virtually everything that I actually wanted to say today. But given that you're just getting comfortable, I'll go on for a few minutes. In this short statement, Churchill set out the basis for a moral compass for criminal justice, and in particular, imprisonment. But for him, a moral prison is an oxymoron. For him, morality in this context was a direction, not a place. Prison is always the deliberate infliction of pain, and it's therefore difficult to reconcile with moral principles. But this notion of a direction rather than a place, like, we had a commissioner a few years back, Ole Engstrup, who I admired a lot, a commissioner of the Correctional Services of Canada. I'm generally not fans of commissioners of corrections, but I was a fan. I appreciated him because he had a principle-based approach to criminal justice. And in the first thing he did as commissioner was to set out those principles in a very long and substantial mission statement, which set very high standards. And that mission statement was frequently used against him as a criticism because of its obvious failure, that every day in the exercise of their duties they fell short of those principles. His response to that was, sailors use the North Star not because they think they're going to get there, but they use it to help them to get to someplace better. You know, it gives them a direction, even though they know that ultimately they'll never reach the North Star. The moral element of our criminal justice system is reflected in what we do to restrain our use of power. And to moderate the harm that our steps take. That is the direction. Something that deprives us of all that a free man calls life is, even in its most restrained form, torture. But it's never benign. It's never in its most restrained form. Aside from the deprivation that prison entails, you must add the fear, the violence, the deprivation, the capriciousness, and the cruelty that are often part of that experience. Imprisonment leaves a dark, permanent stain on all those who experience it. Now, I use the word torture advisedly. Torture is generally defined as an action or practice of inflicting severe physical or mental pain on someone as a punishment in order to force them to do or say something. In the definition of the United Nations, they exclude lawful sanctions. So the same act is torture or not on the basis of whether it's legal, rather than on the basis of the felt experience of those who go through it. I've been told repeatedly, and I'm always interested in talking to people who've been in jail and are out now and doing well. I'm much more interested to know why people are successful than rather than why people fail, because I think there's far more to learn from that. But I have been, if I've been told once, I've been told 100 times by them that once you're a prisoner, you're always a prisoner. That the prison experience is a trauma that changes you. And no matter how successful you are, no matter how you've reconciled in your life, in the back of your mind, you've gone through a deep series of humiliating experiences that will never be forgotten. It's an experience in which a person is totally vulnerable to the decisions, preferences, rules of others, and has virtually no self-direction that they can explore without that kind of restraint. And so it becomes an endless process of humiliation. And that's what imprisonment is, as I see it. It's an endless process of humiliation. And I think we know that. You know, we hear today this debate that prison is club-fed. It's kind of a fun place to go to. So it can't be a deterrent. It's got to be harsher. It's got to be longer, more painful. And a lot of people nod their heads to this. There's whole movements that are trying to sell this notion. And yet I've never seen a person of means who would not spend every cent they have to avoid even the shortest period of time in a prison. When we come to those prison gates face to face, we know this is no club fed. Now, I expect that Churchill would have been delighted if he could conceive of a society that didn't need prisons, or didn't have prisons. He was not a prison abolitionist. He knew that the state needed to respond to crime. It needed to assure people they are right to follow the law and to not hurt others. And he knew that mankind had not evolved to the point where it had either the imagination or the will to avoid the use of imprisonment entirely. But he also knew that prison, in fact, had been invented and was intended to limit the use of even harsher punishments in the past. Death, transportation, physical torture. In fact, the creation of the prison as a place to serve a sentence was in many respects intended to be a humane development in the criminal justice system. And indeed, one of the people credited with the development of the notion of the prison was John Howard in the 16th century. The fact that some measures intended to humanize and curtail the excessive cruelty of the times were themselves far from moral only underscores the fact that the moral compass is, in fact, a direction, not a place. The morality of a justice system is entirely a function of whether those who are responsible for it are committed to moving in the direction of minimizing the harm the system does to those subjected to it. That's where the expression prison as punishment, rather than prison for punishment, is derived. In the modern concept, people go to prison as punishment. It's the loss of liberty, and only the loss of liberty, that is the punishment. All the other horrible things that happen are unintended consequences. They're absolutely predictable, but unintended. To do otherwise is to embrace torture as a worthwhile end in itself. When punishment is considered to be a worthwhile end in itself, there is never enough of it. So long as crime continues, and it always does, there is the demand for more and harsher punishment. Punishment and justice becomes synonymous. The counterweight to this, to the thrust for harsher punishments, is the belief in human rights. Human rights are the law that give form and structure to an unfaltering faith that there is a treasure, if you can only find it, in the heart of every man. And therefore, that all people are entitled to be treated with decency, not because we earned it, but because we are human beings. It is also bound up in the notion that unless we all have human rights, none of us have human rights. When rights become discretionary, they're not rights. The rights of the best among us are directly tied up in the rights of the worst among us. Much of the development of human rights as an important component of the criminal justice system has come about since the Second World War, and I attribute the war itself and the experience of the war to the motivation for much of that. The John Howard Society across Canada grew from a few offices to offices, 60 offices almost, in a period of about 5 years after the Second World War. And why? Well, I knew many of the people who started the John Howard Society. They were all veterans, pretty much. They were all people who had fought in the war in a circumstance where their life depended on their relationship and their belief in the people who were with them, and it mattered not a whit what their fathers made, or the size of their homes, or whether they had a fancy car. It was a great equalizer. So the accent or the background or the cultural things didn't matter. And they all said, in various ways, there but for the grace of God go I. They always believed that the life that many leave could have happened to them. And so there was a tremendous impetus after the war for social services generally across the country. The whole social welfare initiatives were largely brought to bear with this recognition. At the same time, we began to recognize what happens when human rights are ignored. And of course, the worst example is the Holocaust, where people have no value as a human being. But we also found lots of other examples, some of them homegrown, where people's rights were ignored. We interned the Japanese. We had a head tax on the Chinese. We sterilized the mentally retarded. And we put Aboriginal children in schools, depriving three generations of mothers the opportunity to raise their own children. All of these were gross repudiations of human rights. But they were also popular in their day. This wasn't forced on the general population. It was supported by the general population. That's important to me, to remember as we apologize and think, how could the people have done that, was that we're not immune from that. We can easily be panicked into the moral crisis today that gives rise to those circumstances if we don't have something that roots us. When you think of the harm done, the massive harm for these measures, there's no criminal in our society today or ever in the past that can be equated with that level of harm for so many people over such a long period of time. We have to understand that we can be victims of the state as much as we can be victims of individuals. And we also need to understand that we can't abandon human rights just because it's popular. We can't abandon human rights just because the victim of that abandonment is unpopular. So it's not surprising that in 1947, the UN Conventions on Human Rights were adopted. This wasn't just Canada that was going through this awakening. It was the world. We've also seen, particularly since then, the continuous entrenchment of human rights as a foundational concept, moral concept, in our criminal justice system. In the 60s and 70s, we abolished the death penalty in Canada. In 1971, we had a horrible riot in Kingston Penitentiary. I was there at the time. It was at the beginning of my career, and I can tell you, a riot of that scale is a very salutary experience. It was for me, it was for the staff, and it certainly was for the prisoners. I went to see the prisoners, many of the prisoners, in the aftermath, and I can tell you, every person I saw was a traumatized person, terrified by the breakdown of order in the prison. I met no one who thought this was a party. In the years that followed the riot, the Canadian prison system had more further riots, hostage takings, murders, and suicides, and self-mutilations than in the previous 50 years. The explanation that was common at the time by prison officials was prisoners are just worse than they used to be. We got real prisoners in the system now, not like the old guys. And so the response was lockdowns, punishment, transfers far across the country, and other various forms of oppression, segregation. Lockdown is segregation. It's where you're basically in your cells for months. It was so clearly a crisis that Parliament put together an all-party committee to investigate under the chairmanship of Mark McGuigan. This consisted of all the political parties. It was a justice committee. It was very much a political body. But they undertook to investigate these issues in detail. And that included going to the prisons and actually talking to prisoners. The conclusion, unanimous conclusion, to put it in a nutshell, of this committee was that the prison service was indeed in a crisis. And fundamental to that crisis, at the base of it, was that there was no justice in prison. Justice ended at the prison gates. The treatment of prisoners was arbitrary. It was coercive. And it made people desperate. The other thing that influenced them, I think, and it's in their report, was from the moment that this commission was announced and the information went out that they were going to be going into the prisons all across Canada and talking to any prisoner who wanted to talk to them, the violence stopped. It stopped almost completely. That had a profound impact on the committee, and it made it clear that it was the perception of a lack of justice made people desperate. The perception that a system without justice is a system of abuse. The prisoners could accept punishment, but they couldn't accept injustice. And so the recommendation was that the prison system had to follow the law. It seemed like a novel idea. We're still talking about the end of the period when prisons were seen as places that held people without rights. Mark McGuigan and his committee said, no, there has to be some rights. A few years later, we had the Charter of Rights and Freedom. So what was happening within the prison system was also happening with society as a whole. And we created a law that's the highest law. The highest law in the land is the one who articulates your rights as a citizen in this country. And the immediate implication of that was that the law, the penitentiary service law of the day, was clearly unconstitutional. Those in government knew that either they had to rewrite the law to make it consistent with the constitutional requirements, or the courts would do it. And would do it probably in a fairly ad hoc manner. So it was in their interest to sort that out. They went through an 8-year process of consultation. Position papers were written on every major topic in criminal justice, extensive feedback from the community and anyone else who was interested. And And a law was developed that was a principle-based law. It said, for instance, that the purpose of corrections, there was only two. One was to contribute to a just, peaceful, and safe society. First, by operating institutions that were safe and humane. And secondly, to reintegrate people into the community as law-abiding citizens. Punishment's not mentioned. It was reduce the harm and try by addressing the needs of prisoners to help them regain and re-enter society as law-abiding. It's a very principled document. Those principles also, at the same time, were being reinforced by the Supreme Court of Canada in many decisions, which began to define and clearly embed the notion of human rights framework. And so the name changed. The name of the act went from the Penitentiary Service Act to the Correctional Service Act. We went from penitentiary to correctional. And it became clear, you cannot correct people through oppression. You can't make them worse and better at the same time. The correction, as it has been in all of our lives, when we think of the things that influenced us most, it's the positive things, it's the families, it was the learning experience, it was the opportunities. So we developed in this law two of many important principles. One was the idea that prisoners retain certain rights of citizenship. There is no such thing, by the way, as prisoners' rights. Parliament never sat down and thought, what special rights will we give prisoners? What they have are your rights. Or put it this way, you have rights, some of which you retain, even if you go to prison. Now, you don't retain them all. In fact, you lose those that are necessarily removed by virtue of imprisonment. But that leads to the second notion, and that's the least restrictive means. That if you're going to deprive people of their rights, you do so no more than necessary. If you're going to coerce people, it's no more than necessary to meet a legal or a lawful objective. This notion of least restrictive means, people get prickly sometimes about that when you talk about prisons, but in fact it's true of the criminal justice system as a whole. We expect that the police will use no more force than necessary. I mean, as a democracy, we give certain people enormous power. Power to carry guns, to arrest, to shoot sometimes. We expect the courts to sentence, and the sentencing principles stay quite explicitly, no more onerous than necessary. And we expect corrections to be no more onerous than necessary. It's implicit trust in a democracy if we're going to give some of our members that kind of power that can be asserted over us, then it would be only that which is necessary. That which can be justified. Now, in 1996, these principles were well entrenched. I think for some of us working in the field, and certainly for me, I thought these were so well entrenched that they weren't vulnerable. Not only were they in the law, but they made so much sense. They were so much part of the culture of the day. But in 1996, our government decided that they wanted to change the way corrections worked. They had promised to have a committee investigate and review corrections, but it became a problem because there was absolutely nobody with any expertise who would tell them what they wanted to hear. And so they formed a committee, clearly politically partisan in its makeup, that was given an enormous mandates that would have kept five royal commissions busy for 5 years. Talking about things like the effectiveness of programs, the best ways to address the problems of Aboriginals and women in prisons. But it also went on to infrastructure and financing, security. And with this mandate, they were given 50 days. 50 days to produce a report. Now, I always say to people, how much do you think you would know after 50 days? If you were to investigate, read the literature, visit the prisons, debate the issues, and come to a thoughtful report. Perhaps it's not surprising that in their recommendations, two of the recommendations, well, none of their recommendations mentioned human rights, even though it was the foundation of the law and grew out of enormous incidents of violence and harm, very difficult learning experiences in Canada. None of that was mentioned. There was one paragraph in their 107-page document that reflected on history, and it was wrong. The two of the most important principles, human rights principles, retention of rights and least restrictive measures, would be virtually abolished in their recommendations. They were going to replace retention of rights with retention of basic rights. Except nobody knew what a basic right was. A right is a right is a right. We're going to leave it to administrators to decide if this is a basic right or some other right that now becomes a privilege. Least restrictive would be replaced with appropriate. So at least restrictive measures become appropriate measures. What are appropriate measures? We knew what least restrictive was. The Supreme Court had ruled on this frequently. There was a whole series of elements to least restrictive. It had to be for a lawful purpose. It had to be serious to restrain rights, and it had to be proportional. If you're going to limit rights, it's only to the extent necessary. But what's appropriate? Well, I think the best example I can give of appropriate was a comment made by the Minister of Public Safety, Vic Taves, in addressing the questions of double bunking, where two men are in a cell designed for one for many hours at a time, and was a principle that is clearly addressed by the UN standards, clearly addressed within the Correctional Services of Canada's standards, as a least desirable form of imprisonment. And what he said was, double bunking's no big deal. And as he put it, double bunking is appropriate when it's used appropriately. That's what appropriate means. I sat in front of the Justice Committee to testify on Bill C-10, where the chairman of this roadmap committee, Rob Sampson, argued that longer sentences were justified in Canada so that those who were uneducated and unemployed could become trained to work and have education. My response to that was, we don't put people in jail because they're unemployed or uneducated. Why would we keep them in jail? Because they're unemployable or uneducated. And what made this worse was the day before, the correctional investigator, Howard Sapers, had provided detailed data to the Senate, which showed that the core programs that were considered necessary for people to be considered for parole or release were available to less than 10% of the prison population on any day. A longer sentence was, in fact, an invitation to sit on the waiting list longer. There are two kinds of laws in Canada that are relevant to my talk that I want to just talk about a bit. We have the criminal laws. When you're a victim of crime, someone has deprived you of your rights. And we have quite a network that responds to that. We have thousands, tens of thousands of police who investigate. We have Crown prosecutors who will prosecute for us. We don't have to do it ourselves. We don't pay to prosecute. We've got a plethora of courts with highly trained people to hear the case. We've got correctional institutions and other kinds of services throughout the country. And we have some programs and treatments that will help address that. It's quite a substantial and expensive response. But what happens when the other kinds of protection laws, and that is where your rights are being threatened by the state, your human rights are being challenged. Human rights protect us, ensure that we're treated decently by the state. There's no police who investigate. There's no Crown that prosecutes. If you're going to prosecute, you pay for it, and it's not cheap. And you're litigating against the most powerful and richest body in the country, the government. Those most vulnerable to abuses are the ones with the greatest difficulty having access to the justice system. Which raises the question, does that make the Constitution meaningless? I would say yes, unless government in all of its actors and servants understand and complies with human rights willingly. In real terms, the Charter offers us no significant protections in the face of a government that chooses to disregard human rights when it suits them. For us to have human rights, we need to know that our government and their agents understand human rights. We need to know that our leaders believe in human rights. We need to know that they appreciate the defense of our human rights is at the very core of democracy, and as such, it's their fundamental obligation to safeguard, both in law and practice. In practical terms, respect for human rights will not exist in the prison environment unless they exist in the hearts and minds of those who work there, and they're not going to exist in the hearts and minds of those who work there unless they also exist in the hearts and minds of our political leaders. We can't expect the guard in the darkest hole of Millhaven Penitentiary to be deeply respectful of human rights under the circumstances he may be facing, which I can assure you are very trying at times. If those that are comfortably sat in the House of Commons can't do better. And he will be the first to figure that out. Prisons, by their very nature, have three characteristics that we always have to worry about. First, they have enormous authority. There's no other government agency in Canada, in a democracy, that has more power than a prison. Prisons are inherently secret. The walls keep people in, but they also keep people out. All we really know about what goes on in prisons is what we're told by the prison system. And the people in the system are inherently unpopular. They're the ones that have harmed us. They're the ones that have frightened us. That combination of power, secrecy, and lack of popularity is fertile ground for abuse of human rights. And a system that is not respectful, deeply respectful of human rights, is one that necessarily tolerates abuse. It teaches that might is right. For the prisoner in that system who knows that he's being dealt with unfairly, in an unjust manner, knows that this happens because the powerful get their way. And I can tell you, working with prisoners all my life, that's very often how they see the world, themselves. It reinforces the notion that it's not that power does not come from being right, it comes from being powerful. And as such, I deeply believe that it's not possible to have a system that you call correctional that teaches that might is right. Michael Jackson, the lawyer from BC, and I undertook to write a long critique of this roadmap for corrections. For a number of reasons, we obviously disagreed with its content, but we were also really shocked to see that a document that was so far-reaching and so profound was adopted quietly inside Correctional Services of Canada within a few months without any public consultation, any discussion of its implications. And in fact, was announced as the transformative agenda for the Correctional Services of Canada and their roadmap for the future. Our critique was, of course, the notion that human rights is not something you balance with control and coercion of the states inside the prison. It's the thing that guides coercion and control. It's the thing that puts the limits on it and makes sure that while we have to have some control in prisons, it can never be morally justified unless it's inherently respectful of the humanity of the individuals in it. The response, I think, was telling, and probably for me has been the most chilling experience for me. The minister at the time was Peter Van Loan, and he was quoted. His response was quoted in the Globe and Mail, and it went like this. The article or comment goes like this. Their analysis was immediately dismissed by Public Safety Minister Peter Van Loan, who made a point of referring repeatedly to Jackson as the professor. Quote, "The professor has a different philosophy than us," Van Loan told CBC News World. "We think the protection of society has to come first." And we hear that a lot. But if you think about that for a moment, what you're really hearing is that our human rights are inconsistent with our safety. And I would suggest there's no totalitarian regime in the world that doesn't espouse human rights, providing it doesn't interfere what they define as public safety. Voltaire said, "Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities." The bill that came out of this most recently, the great Omnibus Crime Bill, C-10, is much too long and involved for me to give any detail. I'm only going to talk about a couple of points that are most germane to this thesis I'm putting forward. Let me say, though, that the bill is a punishment bill. There's virtually nothing in that legislation that I would see as being anything more than upping the ante. But two things stand out. One was the notion of mandatory minimum sentences. The interesting thing about mandatory minimum sentences is that the only people they really apply to are the least serious. The ones where the average citizen would say, well, there are mitigating circumstances here. Technically, the crime meets a serious category, but in its acting out, a thinking judge, looking at the evidence, having heard the case and the arguments from both sides, really felt that a shorter sentence was just. We have no room for that kind of justice now. We force the least severe offender to undergo at least a certain level of punishment. One cannot reconcile that with the notion of least restrictive means. Least owners. And of course, mandatory minimums transfer much of what happens in the sentencing process from the judge to the Crown. Well, what happens in court is open. And you get detailed reasons. Judges don't just say 5 years and sit down and go away. They will always justify according to the principles of law, proportionality, and the objectives of sentencing. What that was about, you might not agree with it. But if it's not reasonable, it will be appealed. But what's decided in the Crown's office is not apparent. It's not in the public. We don't know how many people will plead guilty only because if they don't, they will be charged with an offense that has a mandatory minimum, and it becomes a huge risk. We don't know what other kinds of intimidation may have occurred in that environment. We don't know because it's secret. The other thing that's happened that I think is very telling is the virtual abolition of pardons. To me, a pardon is a celebration of success. I mean, if anything, it says that the justice system wasn't completely destructive and may even have helped some people. It was a recognition that a person at some point in their life can be admitted more fully back into human society, reintegrated by giving a conditional restriction on the use of their sentence. So it was abolished in its current form, and of course the term was abolished. Instead of getting a pardon now, you will, if you qualify, if you pay very substantial fees, and if you go through an onerous process that's highly politicized, you will get a record suspension. Well, clearly those words carry very different meaning and importance to people. And I think it's very telling that within a few weeks of having abolished pardons, the Prime Minister undertook to grant pardons on the announcement that the Wheat Board provisions had been taken out of law to grant pardons to the farmers who had been charged with criminal offenses, not Wheat Board offense, criminal offenses in relation to taking back equipment that had been pounded by the border guards. He used a term that had been abolished. There is no such thing. He provided this for the first time in history as a grand gesture of a prime minister, as opposed to a person who had applied, paid the fees, gone through the application process. And as such, and he used the term because he knew record suspension would never mean anything. Okay, so let me conclude then. If a moral compass for criminal justice is a direction rather than a place, then in recent times we've swung 180 degrees from the direction proposed by Winston Churchill and those that followed for the succeeding 90 years. If restraint in the use of power of the state against its system measures the stored-up strength of a nation, and it's the sign and proof of the living virtue in it, we do not have much to be proud of today. Now, I was thinking about this. I was thinking, Graham, you can't land on an entirely negative tone. So I tried to think of how I could say something positive. And there were two things. First of all, we know better. If we stop and think, if we look at the development of law as we have over the last century, it's clear. And if we look at the evidence, there's been research. Not all of these things are just beliefs. There's solid, accumulating evidence that treating people in a purely punitive way makes them worse. Treating people in a hopeful way, one in which we attempt to provide opportunities for them and help them see the opportunities, we'll get better results than less crime. The other positive thing, aside from the knowledge, just perhaps for me, events like this, a speaker series, in which people actually want to know. The citizens will seek a moral compass to set a direction in our quest for a just system in a just society. So for me, it's these kinds of events that make me most hopeful that where we're going today is a temporary reversal and not the future we face in having a justice system that honors us as citizens. Thank you.